All right, I think we can begin. Welcome, everyone.
I don't think you owe me any money, but thank you.
Some of you, I think, have not been with us in previous sessions, is that right? If you have not been here before and would be interested in one of the handouts from previous sessions, I'll send this around. It has, on the one side, the photo of the ELCA's presiding bishop, Mark Hansen, with the Lutheran bishop in Palestine, Muni Bionan, at the separation barrier near Bethlehem. I think it was taken about 5 years ago when the Lutheran World Federation was having a council meeting there. And at the time, Mark Hansen was the president of the Lutheran World Federation. And last month in Stuttgart at the LWF assembly, Muni Bionan was elected the new president of the Lutheran World Federation. So the two most recent presidents of LWF are pictured in that photo. On the other side of that same page is the outline of the ELCA's campaign, Peace Not Walls, which is an education and action campaign on the Israel-Palestine agenda, the way of getting ELCA members and congregations involved with seeking a just peace in that part of the world. A little bit about my own background with this concern, for those of you who have not been here before, I'll just summarize it quickly. I made my first visit to the Holy Land in the early 80s, I think it was 82, when I was with a group organized by the YMCA in Minneapolis. It was led by a couple who had been working at the YMCA in Nazareth in Galilee for a number of years. They took a group of us there, and that was my first experience on the ground to the Israel-Palestine conflict. I've been back, I think, 8 times since. After that 82 visit, I was there in 91 when I was on the board of Lutheran World Relief, and I was on a monitoring visit as a board member to look at the work that Lutheran World Relief was supporting in the Holy Land. And then after that, I 5 times have led groups there on pilgrimage visits. And I've been there also a couple of times without leading groups at conferences in the Holy Land, one of which was in Bethlehem, organized by the Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem, Mitri Raheb, who is pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. And I'd like to begin our conversation today by reading a quote, a comment from Mitri. I should also say that my congregation in Minneapolis, Lutheran Church of Christ the Redeemer, has been a sister parish to Christmas Lutheran for a little over 20 years. And so we've had exchanges in both directions with Palestinians coming to see us and members of our congregation going there over these last 20 years. But Mitri Raheb makes a comment which is in the book that I that I've been drawing from all week, that I co-authored with Robert Smith a few years ago, called Christians in a Land Called Holy. It is about the indigenous Christian community in the Holy Land and the responsibility of Christians in the rest of the world, including the United States and Canada, to be more engaged in the activities that seek a just peace in that land between those two peoples. Mitri has often been in the U.S. He was here most recently in July of this year in Minneapolis for the Presbyterian Church USA General Assembly, because he had been invited by them to come as a resource to the assembly as they dealt with a rather major statement and strategy statement that they were developing on the Israel-Palestine conflict. But this is what I want to share from Mitri. He's writing about hope and the need for hope for people who are living in the Holy Land, and the need for people in other parts of the world to join them in being hopeful and in pursuing a successful completion of the peace process. He writes, a hopeful vision is important for American and European Christians, not because they need to be pro-Palestinian, but because they need to stop being spectators in their own countries. We are not asking for more statements on the Middle East. We are asking for action, not only for our sake, but also for their own sake. Citizens of these countries, basically Western nations he's talking about, North America and the Atlantic nations and Europe, citizens of these countries must care that their money be spent not to subsidize the Israeli occupation, but to create a just peace in the region. Christian hope holds firm that it's never too late for faith in action and for acts of compassion. Christian hope does not surrender to the forces of death and despair, but challenges them. That comes from a book he did a few years ago, which is titled
I'm Not So Good.
Signs of Hope. He writes about the need for among Palestinians and Israelis, but also for people in the rest of the world to be hopeful about the prospects for peace, and he also gives a number of examples that point in that direction. Well, he basically, in calling for actions, is talking about two things. How we do advocacy in our own, with our own governments in the West, and how we put our money where our mouth is. How we use our economic resources in the pursuit of peace. And so the sessions this afternoon and tomorrow afternoon are going to pick up those two elements. Today, citizen advocacy for U.S., and I think you could also say for Canadian people, and how we use our money, both in supporting efforts toward peace and in withdrawing money that is not doing that, such as in the case of the United States, the massive amount of aid that we give as taxpayers every year to the state of Israel, and how can that be used in a way, or subtracted in a way, that encourages the peace, the development of a just peace. And we'll deal with that tomorrow. But this afternoon, political advocacy. And I want to begin by talking about the role of the United States government, because almost everybody who has had anything to do with the Israel-Palestine situation, with that conflict, which has now gone on for at least 60 years, almost everyone says it is not going to be resolved unless the United States government at the highest level, meaning the presidency, gets involved with the pursuit of peace and pressing for peace. Because of the significant role that our government plays, that our nation plays, not only in terms of financial support for the state of Israel, which is now, since the Camp David Accords of 1979 that Jimmy Carter worked out between Israel and Egypt, part of the agreement was that the United States would give major aid, both to Israel and to Egypt, but to Israel it's more. And since that time, it has been over $100 billion in aid that the United States Treasury, you and me as taxpayers, if we're U.S. citizens, taxpayers, have given to the state of Israel. It's by far the largest aid package every year to any country in the world. In fact, the aid to Israel that the United States gives annually is more than we give to all of the countries of Africa. And we do it, of course, not because Israel is a poor country. Israel really isn't a poor country. It's not a developing country. It's a you have to say, part of the first world nations. We give it with no strings attached, much of it in the form of military aid, armaments. The only string attached is that the armaments have to be provided by U.S. arms makers, so it benefits, provides jobs for Americans while we're doing it. And that's one of the reasons it's hard to get it eliminated, because it would affect our own economy internally. But also, the United States, as the sole remaining superpower, has tremendous influence with all parties in the region. Most, if not all, observers say it is not. There's not going to be peace between Israel and Palestine until the United States government gets involved and demands it, insists on it. And that's, to a degree at least, that's been going on now through a number of presidencies, certainly starting with Jimmy Carter, but down to the very present. The Obama announcement shortly after he was inaugurated that he was going to make peace between Israel and Palestine a priority. And he was on the telephone to Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Mahmoud Abbas, the President of the Palestinian Authority, the day after he was inaugurated. And shortly after that, he made a major speech in Cairo, basically addressed to the Muslim world, the Arab world, and the rest of the Muslim world. But he, early in his administration, he appointed Senator George Mitchell, former Senator Mitchell, as the envoy from the United States government to the Holy Land to work on reviving the peace process, getting them back to talk to each other, which they hadn't been doing for almost all of the years of the Bush administration, and getting back to the table, to face-to-face. And that George Mitchell is still about that, though they haven't gotten back to face-to-face talks yet. Okay, so the role of the United States government is significant. We have to be aware that we are seen by most of the world as hypocritical and two-faced, the United States government, when it comes to that particular conflict, that we have a double standard. We expect certain things on the part of the Arab nations that we don't expect from Israel. And a good example of that, I think, would be the nuclear issue. It's generally known that Israel has nuclear weapons. They have developed nuclear weapons, and that they hold them without international supervision, without international inspection. And the United States really has not been critical about that, has not been taking that concern or supporting that concern in the United Nations. But we've been very concerned about the development of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Iraq was developing weapons of mass destruction under Saddam Hussein, and we went to war about that. Today we're concerned about the development of nuclear weapons by Iran, and we're threatening with Israel all kinds of things about that development, from economic sanctions to even the possibility of military action. But we don't say anything about the fact that Israel has weapons of mass destruction.
We haven't acknowledged that they haven't, have we?
For the most part, no. It has occasionally been mentioned in recent months. I think at one point there was a mention of it in something that came out of the Secretary of State, out of Hillary Clinton's mouth, but for the most part we have not. And we certainly have not made any kind of issue of it. So that's how we're seen. We're seen as not fair and balanced and even-handed when we approach the Israel-Palestine conflict by most of the world. We're seen as always tilting toward Israel. And in that connection, I heard a joke when I was in Israel from an Israeli peace activist who said, Israel is really behaving like the 51st state of the U.S. But he said there's a reason why we don't want to become the 51st state. You know what it is? Well, the reason is, for example, in the United States Senate, if we became the 51st state, we'd have two Senate voices, we'd have two senators. And as it is now, when they vote in the Senate, most of the time we have 90 to 100 votes voting our way. So why would we settle for two senators when we have 90 to 100 usually? And, you know, Israelis, I think, certainly the Israeli left, has a little bit of discomfort about this alliance between the U.S. and Israel. And certainly when you're searching for peace between Israelis and Palestinians, the Israeli left, such as it is, thinks that the United States ought to play a more moderating and more balanced and even-handed role than we have played traditionally. So we're not seen in the world community as even-handed when we talk about being a broker for peace. And we are also seen, I would have to say, this is the other part of it, that we're seen as the prime enabler of Israel's continued occupation of another people. With our money and with our armed support and with our shielding of Israel from any kind of global sanctions, we, with our veto in the UN Security Council, you know, the five major powers, Britain, France, Russia, the US, and China, have a veto in the Security Council, so that an action of the Security Council can be supported by all but one of those five and be defeated because of the veto. We have vetoed 69 resolutions in the Security Council that were slapping the hands of Israel or judging Israel or critical of Israel or calling on Israel to do something because we thought it was not in the interest of Israel, so we vetoed 69 times. It's in our own national interest, I think, and many people now think, to change that, to bring, to get back to the peace talks and to bring about a just peace to the Holy Land, and to use our immense power as a balanced, even-handed facilitator of the movement toward peace. A couple of statements from within our own government on that point I want to share. One came from the 9/11 Commission back in 2004. This was the bipartisan commission that was set up by Congress to analyze what was behind the 9/11 attack and what we should be doing about it. And so one of the words in that report was this: right or wrong, it is simply a fact that American policy regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and American actions in Iraq, which at that time, 2004, was a major activity going on, are dominant staples of popular commentary across the Arab and Muslim world. That does not mean U.S. choices have been wrong. It means those choices must be integrated with America's message of opportunity to the Arab and Muslim world. Neither Israel nor the new Iraq will be safer if worldwide Islamist terrorism grows stronger. So that commission's report saw that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how the United States is viewed in relation to that is a significant factor in how the United States is viewed throughout the Arab and Muslim world. I don't think there's any question about that. A similar statement was made more recently by General Petraeus, who said that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the way the United States is viewed in relation to it makes our military, makes our defense force in the Middle East much less secure. In other words, it's against the interests of the United States, and particularly our military presence in the region,
the way we are viewed by much of the Muslim and Arab world in relation to the Israel-Palestine situation. Now, what about the peace process? In quotes, you've got to almost feel a kind of cynical when you talk about the peace process, because if process means movement, there ain't much. And that's been true for a long time. There have been peace processes under the Clinton administration, under the Bush administration, and now with the Obama administration, and they never seem to move any closer to peace. I think you have to say, to his credit, that Jimmy Carter did bring about peace between Egypt and Israel, and that was significant. And that was done basically at the very highest level. Carter himself brought the parties to Camp David in 1979, and they worked it out. But since then, the peace process between Palestine and Israel really hasn't accomplished much. It's, I think, obvious that in any kind of final resolution of the conflict, it's the two parties themselves that have to hammer out an agreement, have to reach an agreement. But the U.S. government at the highest level has to be involved as a convener, as an insister, as a prodder, as an enabler, as a stimulator, as a, you could say, demander that they come up with a final agreement. And that job today is given to Senator Mitchell. He's the one who worked out a final agreement in Northern Ireland, you may recall, and he's considered a very savvy negotiator. So far, it's not clear that anything is happening. There are, what do they call them? They're not direct talks, they're indirect talks. Each side talking with Senator Mitchell and his staff, but separately, not together. They aren't yet talking face to face. Whether that'll come about in the near future remains to be seen. One of the issues that has been holding up their face-to-face talks is the continuing Israeli activity in building settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. And back in January, I think it was, the Palestinians have said they will not go to peace talks until building of settlements stops. Back in January, Netanyahu declared that they would put a moratorium on further building of settlements for 8 months. In the West Bank, but not in East Jerusalem. In East Jerusalem, there's a continuing, what is called Judaization, trying to get rid of Arab or Palestinian residents, of whom there are about 250,000 in East Jerusalem. That's the part of Jerusalem that has always been Arab, and that the Palestinians have said from the very beginning they will want to have as their capital in any kind of two-state, any creation of a Palestinian state. So the expansion of settlements in the East Jerusalem continues, that may be why, and the moratorium on building in the West Bank is going to expire next month, in September. So it doesn't look too good at this point for getting back to the face-to-face talks. What is the agenda for those talks? Well, it's pretty much the same as it's always been. Three basic issues have to be resolved. One is borders. What is the territory going to be like that will be Israel and Palestine? And that, of course, includes the question of what do you do with the settlements? You've got these settlements in the West Bank that include about 300,000 people. They are in areas of the West Bank that Israel has now built a security barrier around, a wall. And many people think that Israel is trying to define the ultimate border by placing the wall where it is, that's the new border as Israel unilaterally is trying to create it. And most observers say that if there is to be some of that land of the West Bank given and kept within within Israel proper after there's a final agreement, there should be an equal amount of land in a swap from Israel proper to the West Bank, given to the West Bank, so that the amount of land, it's been about 22% of British Mandate Palestine that is Palestinian territory today, and 78% that is Israel. And if you want to have any kind of land reality, any division of the land that is fair and just to the Palestinians, they have to keep at least 22% of that. And if some of the settlements go into Israel proper, what would be the included on the Israel side of the final border that's agreed to, there should be an equal amount of land made available to the Palestinians from Israel that is not now settled. Second issue in the peace process, of course, is how or if Jerusalem will be shared. The Palestinians have insisted that the Palestinian part of Jerusalem must be part of the Palestinian state and must be their capital. So, in other words, you'd have a Jerusalem in which is the capital of two states. West Jerusalem, capital of Israel, and East Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine. And many people say that the reason the Clinton-led talks in 2000 and 2001, very close to the end of the Clinton administration's time, second term, finally broke down because they couldn't come to agreement on how to share Jerusalem. The third one is what to do with the Palestinian refugees. Under international law, refugees from any kind of military conflict, refugees are defined as product produced by military conflict. Once the conflict is over, refugees have a right to return to their original home or homeland. And there were 700,000 Palestinian refugees, mostly out of the Galilee, when the State of Israel was created back in 48, the result of the war that happened when the Arab nations went to war against the new State of Israel and said, we're not going to accept you. And they lost, the Arab states did. But one result of that conflict was about 700,000 Palestinians were either forced out or fled. And today they number, and they're all still considered refugees, with children and grandchildren, they number about 4 million. And they're in refugee camps, many of them, most of them are in refugee camps who are administered by the United Nations under the UN Agency for Relief and Works, UNRWA. Many of them are in Gaza, some are in the West Bank. I have visited refugee camps in Bethlehem. They are in Jordan, they are in Lebanon, they are in other parts of the Middle East, and a fair number of them have emigrated to North America and Europe. But they, under international law, they have a right, they and their children and grandchildren, if they wish, to return to their country of origin. Israel has said never, because if even a significant fraction of them came back to Israel and became citizens of Israel, Israel would no longer be a Jewish majority state. Yes?
When you talk about refugee camps, there's people who have been living in them since 1948.
Yeah.
So are they actual, they're not tents and rows of tents. Do they actually have permanent type
homes? Oh, yeah, they're permanent. They have permanent residences, and some of them have work, and they do, they go to jobs, and they have schools, they have educational opportunity for their children. Yeah, all of that is administered by the United Nations.
Oh, okay.
The support for it comes from countries who donate to it, including the United States. And occasionally, over the years, there have been moves in our Congress to try to reduce our support for UNRWA because they thought it was, some in Congress thought it was giving too much favor to the Palestinians. It is Palestinians. Gaza, which has about 1.5 million residents, a little slice of land along the Mediterranean, has, of its 1.5 million citizens, over 1 million are refugees. So, you know, it's heavily, Gaza is heavily served in terms of refugee, the refugee population by the international community, the United Nations. Okay, so what to do with refugees? Most people think the final solution to the refugee question will come through some kind of reimbursement to the refugees and their descendants for their loss, some kind of payment, some kind of financial donation to reimburse them for what they lost in terms of property and home. But very few believe that the solution to that will be the usual one, which is the right of return.
So will
to
they
their
stay
point of
where
origin.
They are? Would they stay where they are in these camps,
well,
or wherever they go?
Well, many of them, I think, would probably be settled in the new Palestinian state, in the West Bank primarily. You know, and some of them undoubtedly would prefer to stay where they are if they're already emigrated to a Western nation, but they do have a right to some kind of economic reimbursement for their loss.
From whom?
Yeah.
From whom?
Well, from the world community, probably. I don't think Israel would come up with it. Probably again, U.S. taxpayer would carry a major portion of that. But,
what's a just settlement over there? Where? Between the Palestinians and the Israelites?
Well, a just settlement, I think, would be one that has agreed upon borders, agreed upon sharing of Jerusalem, and some kind of just treatment for the refugees. Those are the three big issues, yeah. Now let's go to the U.S. Congress and the lobbying community. Again, to use a kind of cynical semi-humorous comment from the observers, particularly I think I've heard this from Israeli peace activists, they see that Israel is occupying not only the West Bank and East Jerusalem and, you know, surrounding Gaza. It's no longer with a military presence right in Gaza, but it controls Gaza completely in terms of access and egress, things going in, including people, and things going out, including people, Israel controls. But in addition to the occupied territories, some of the Israeli peace activists like to say that the U.S. Congress is occupied territory by Israel. In other words, they get their way in our Congress over and over again. So what is the reality? I think first it has to be said that Congress in itself, our legislative branch at the federal level, has little direct involvement with the quest for peace or the prevention of peace between Israel and Palestine, except for money. Congress has to vote the money, not only for Israel, for the aid, the traditional aid to Israel package, but also for any kind of money to the Palestinian cause, to the Palestinian Authority, or even for, I mentioned UNRWA. Congress decides how much money will go to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency every year for maintaining the refugee services. Congress decides if we will fund, if the United States will fund human rights activities in Palestine. humanitarian programs in Palestine. Congress, even through the U.S. Agency for International Development, decides, in effect, whether the Lutheran's Hospital on the Mount of Olives will get special equipment for cancer treatment, which it recently did. Augusta Victoria Hospital. How many of you have visited the Holy Land, by the way? Did any of you have a chance to visit Augusta Victoria Hospital? Okay, so you know a little bit about that. It's the major source of medical care for all of the Palestinians in certain specialized areas, cancer treatment being one of them, for the entire West Bank and East Jerusalem population.
Dialysis also.
Dialysis, yes, right. The United States Agency for International Development rather recently gave major new, funded the purchase, the acquisition of major new equipment for dialysis and for I think cancer radiation treatments and such for Augusta Victoria Hospital. So that's an example of U.S. taxpayers doing what I would say is constructive work, is helpful work. Yeah.
What do you know now about the Israeli plan to tax Augusta Victoria Hospital? Did
it fall
through the cracks somewhere?
That first appeared about, I think, almost 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
After the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, in which Israel won and took control of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza, Israel honored the agreement that the Kingdom of Jordan had had with international institutions like Augusta Victoria Hospital, that they would be tax-free. They would be treated as nonprofits, charitable organizations, charitable institutions that should not be taxed. And that was honored until about, the late 90s. And then Israel said, no, they were going to now start to tax those. It wasn't just the Lutheran's hospital, there were some others involved, but the focus initially was on Augusta Victoria Hospital, which is operated by the Lutheran World Federation, an international entity.
And so
the Lutheran World Federation challenged it in the Israeli courts and refused to pay the tax. And it was in the courts, and I guess it's in effect, it's still there. It appears that it is now on hold. Nothing is happening. The last I heard was that from Mark Brown, who is the ELCA pastor, who is the director of the LWF program in Jerusalem, that he thought it was the way Israel was now dealing with it was not to deal with it. So at this point, the tax is not being collected. At one point, they had been in negotiation with the Israeli government with the possibility of paying the tax and then getting the same amount reimbursed to the hospital from another agency of the Israeli government. You know, their Ministry for Human Services or something like that. So they were trying to work out that kind of a deal. But at this point, I think nothing is happening. Well, the lobbying community in the U.S. Congress. What Congress does that relates to Israel-Palestine beyond the money factor is basically for Congress periodically to pass resolutions that are really addressed to the administration. Secretary of State or the President, the White House, or to circulate Dear Colleague letters that say something about the will of Congress or the sense of Congress on a particular issue. So they have some kind of political impact, but they don't really change policy directly. But they're still significant. They're important. There is, I would say, two collections or two orientations within the lobbying community. One is very pro-Israel, that always says whatever the United States government should do, it should always be, it should always take the side of Israel. It should never be even-handed. It should never try to be balanced, because we are an ally of Israel, and you get talked like Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East, things like that. And in that lobbying community, there are two primary pieces. One is AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which has always been very defensive of Israel's behavior and very supportive of whatever Israel wants. The other piece of it is the Christian Zionist group, which is a little more fragmented, but the primary group within that community is the Christians United for Israel, which is a group that is headed by Reverend John Hagee, a fundamentalist Christian pastor in San Antonio. And Hagee keeps arguing that he and his followers need to pursue God's law rather than the U.S. government law, because God's law is supreme. And so let me read to you something he said a few years ago when he was being challenged, because his congregation in San Antonio was giving $1 million to the specific purpose of resettling in the West Bank a large number of Jews from Russia. And he was challenged on that and asked whether that didn't violate U.S. law. And this is what he said. If I can find it here. He said, when asked if he was uncomfortable that his $1 million gift was being made to Israel's effort to resettle Jews in the West Bank could possibly transgress American policy, he replied, "I am a Bible scholar and theologian, and from my perspective, the law of God transcends the law of the United States government and of the U.S. State Department. My former congressman, Martin Sable, in the Minneapolis area, he often would say when we would go to visit with him about the Israel-Palestine agenda, that yes, he got a lot of communication from and visits from AIPAC, but he said, "I get more on the Israel-Palestine agenda from the Christian Zionists than I do from AIPAC, the American Jewish community." The other collection of lobbying efforts on this issue, I would say, are now coming together under what they call the Community of Yes. The Community of Yes. And it was really stimulated, that effort, by J Street, which is another American Jewish lobby. J Street, they kind of tongue-in-cheek called it J Street. It was organized just about 2 years ago, because in Washington, many of the lobbying groups are on K Street, and there is no J Street in the Washington grid, so they've taken J Street for the name of this lobby, J, of course, representing Jewish. And J Street claims to be pro-Israel and pro-peace. And they kind of are suggesting, they are suggesting that they are pro-peace, whereas AIPAC, the other main American Jewish lobby, is not pro-peace. But J Street and Churches for Middle East Peace, which is a coalition of 23 Washington-based offices of denominations, Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox, including the ELCA, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, Episcopalians. In fact, I've got a handout for you that I'll send around that includes a list of most of the denominational websites and the ones that are at work on this issue, Israel-Palestine. And that's a couple years old, because it comes from this book, but I think most of them are still current, the addresses given. But CMEP and J Street have been working together. They sponsored jointly a recent trip by a number of House members, U.S. House members, to Israel-Palestine. And now they have together formed this community of yes. And it includes a number of agencies, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim in the United States. And they are on the other side of that sheet. They're listed. And you can see one of them, I think, is the Islamic Society of North America. There are several, there are some other Jewish groups, and there are some other Muslim groups. And they've come together, and they agree on what should be done by the U.S. government, and I think that's also on your, is that? Yeah, that's there too. That's on their statement of principles. And that'll give you an idea of what they're advocating for with the U.S. government.
There's also a group called the Rabbis for Peace, too, aren't there? Are they included in this list?
There's a group in Israel called Rabbis for Human Rights,
okay.
Which works with Palestinians.
Rabbis in our country? Isn't there a group of rabbis in our country who are working towards the peace process?
Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel has a U.S. support group. Yeah. But I don't think they do much in lobbying. I don't think they do much with the U.S. government. So what do these groups do? Well, they urge members of Congress to be balanced and fair in resolutions and in colleague letters and in legislative actions. They haven't yet come to the point of urging the U.S. Congress to reduce aid to Israel, though some of the groups there favor that. And I think the other thing they do, and will continue to do, is to continue to press the president to keep this issue on the front burner, to not let it recede, but to continue to make it a priority. So we're near the end of our time. Let me stop here and just invite your comments or questions or anything you'd like to have clarified or anything you disagree with that
I
said.
Population.
Les?
You know, question. I'm just thinking about General Petraeus and about our involvement in Afghanistan and ceasing our involvement in Iraq. I'm just wondering what a person like General Petraeus, how he feels in terms of the anger and animosity in the entire Arab community in the world,
mm-hmm.
because of the position of the United States. And is it possible that military dimension of our country will start talking to congressmen and president to say, hey, you know, something's got to be done. I mean, you've given a beautiful example of an impasse that we face right now.
Yeah.
And I just want to say this. Any of you never been to Israel, if you're going to go to Israel, please consider the kind of tour you're going to take. Because 98% of all tourist dollars end up in Israeli hands. And the Zionists, for instance, the Israeli government subsidize them coming to Israel.
Yeah.
And, you know, I made eight trips to Israel, and finally, several years ago, I was awakened to the fact that it's not just holy places, but there are holy people there.
Yeah.
And the holy people
yeah.
are brothers and sisters in the Christian Arab community
yeah.
that need our support.
They are often referred to as the living stones, as opposed to the dead stones of the biblical sites, the ruins. Yeah, and be in touch with the living stones. Yeah.
Another complicating factor in this whole peace process that you didn't mention was the division within the Palestinian community.
Oh, yeah. We talked a little bit about that earlier in the week, the division, political division between Fatah and Hamas and the Palestinian community. Hamas is the party that is running things now to the extent that anything can be run in Gaza. And Fatah is running things in the West Bank to the extent that Israel allows them to have some kind of civil responsibility under occupation. But Yeah, that's a major problem. How do you, some folks have said, again, kind of tongue-in-cheek, or with semi-humor, that you already have a two-state solution for the Palestinians. One is called Gaza, and one is called the West Bank. Two separate governments, two separate political cultures.
Israel uses that to say, well, we won't do anything until they can get together.
That's right, that's right. And, of course, the distinction between them is not just geographic. It's also that Hamas is openly and officially an Islamic party, whereas Fatah, which was the party of Yasser Arafat, and is the party that today is led by Mahmoud Abbas, is officially secular. And so Fatah has a lot of Christians involved. But Hamas in Gaza does not have any involvement from non-Muslims, and it claims to be an Islamic party. And its official position is that the state of Israel has no right to exist.
Right.
It should be eliminated. And the position of Fatah, of course, is very different. Fatah is willing to work out an agreement with the state of Israel so that they can live side by side in peace. Two nations, two peoples. But yeah, that's a major problem. And somehow, at some point, the Palestinians are going to have to get their act together, I think, if they're going to have a Palestinian state that is, if Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem can come together in a Palestinian state, the division between Fatah and Hamas has to be dealt with.
And Israel doesn't want that to happen, so they make sure they,
that's right,
they don't stay together.
In fact, it's often forgotten that the original development of Hamas was funded by Israel.
Really?
Mm. Yeah. 20-some years ago.
Wow.
As a way of dividing the Palestinians, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Another avenue for peacemaking that I would suggest is for religious people to question the justification we've been given for the U.S. wars in the Middle East. And this whole nebulous, I would say, highly dubious idea of Islamic terrorism. I work with a group of, so far, 120 religious leaders who are calling for a new 9/11 investigation. We're one of about 12 professional groups. The others being technical people, scientists, architects, engineers, pilots, firefighters, scholars. And we have been willing to look at the research by highly credentialed scientists and professionals, which severely calls into question many aspects of the official story that do not hold up to scrutiny. And I think we need, as religious people, in order to really love our neighbor in this situation, we need to be willing to question our own assumptions of, do we have a free press and a lot of other issues, about question the information we're getting, just as you have pointed out that the information you have is very different than from what comes through mainstream media.
Yeah.
And what's happening in the Middle East. So I do have some brochures, if it's okay, I can offer people or would be willing to talk to them afterwards.
Yeah.
Or I can check out our website, Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, because I think it's very important. Just you mentioned the reference to the 9/11 Commission Report might be of interest to you as a religious group or group of religious people that Christian theologian David Ray Griffin, was a well-respected scholar, has found at least 100 lies in the 9/11 Commission report in the terms of omissions, distortions, just outright lies. He works with technical people, the architects, the engineers, the firefighters, and people from the intelligence agencies from within our government who have raised questions. The reason that this is very difficult for a lot of normal people, religious people, to even confront is that we assume that if there were anything to this, we would hear it through mainstream news, but that's part of the bigger problem. So just something for you to consider.
Yeah, we talk to some degree about that issue. The sources of our information on the Israel-Palestine reality and how, I wouldn't say they're biased so much as I would say they're incomplete. We don't get much of the Palestinian story. We don't get much of their narrative. We get a lot of the Israeli story and the Israeli narrative, and it's legitimate to get that. But we don't get the other story very much in our mainstream media. I've always been impressed that there is more diversity of opinion and telling of the stories in the Israeli press, the English language Israeli press, than there is in the American press. What does that mean? I think Israel does have a reasonably free press, and they try to tell the whole story, but we don't always get it here. So
following up on that, where do we go to get information? Where would you recommend, what websites or what papers if you wanted to follow this?
I think the reporting on CNN has been relatively complete and decent and fair. I think CNN or CBS 60 Minutes some months ago did a report on the settlement activity that was very, I would say, if not pro-Palestinian, at least it told the story from the perspective of what it meant for the Palestinians to have Israelis coming in and settling on their land. It was fair. So there are examples. There are a lot of websites, as you know, that you can go to for information. There's something called the Electronic Intifada. Intifada is the Arabic word for uprising or shaking off. And it's been one of the Palestinian responses to the, there have been a couple of them, to the occupation. But the Electronic Intifada is a source. Any other comments, questions? Yes, Les?
I just think everybody should hear how proud we can be of LWF and Augusta Victoria Hospital. Augusta Victoria, because of the dialysis and the cancer treatment, they can send a van down to Gaza, and they can get a permit to bring somebody in. They'll keep them there for the termination of their treatment for several weeks. And I think it's just marvelous that, and they're the only hospital that treats the Arabs.
Yeah.
The second thing is that Mitri Rahib, the pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church, he said, every time we get boxed in, God gives me a new idea. They're all nonviolent and all creative. They started at the university, Dar al-Kalima. A school where they bring these kids in from who are living in tents. They put good clothes on them. It's clean. It's beautiful. It's creative. It's biblical and it's Christian.
They have a.
We can be so proud of our church and what it's doing over there.
They have a wellness center.
Yeah.
They have a service they've developed for guides for. Training people to be guides, employment to Palestinians, to welcome pilgrim groups and show them around. They have a guest house. Mm-hmm. They have a restaurant. They even have, as Mitri likes to boast, he did his doctoral work in Germany and fell in love with German beer. And so they have a bar. And he said. When Hamas was elected to a majority of the seats in the Palestinian legislature 3 or 4 years ago, he said, well, you know, I think we can live with that as long as they don't tell our women how they have to dress and don't tell us that we have to close our German bar. Because, as you know, Muslims officially are in disapproval of alcoholic beverages. But the other thing about Augusta Victoria Hospital that I think is significant for us to know is how they operate under extreme difficulty. Just getting staff to and from their work is a challenge every day because many of them live outside of East Jerusalem in the West Bank surrounding Jerusalem, and they always have to get permission from Israeli military checkpoints to get to and from work. And they usually are able to get it, but often they have to wait in line for quite a while, and sometimes they're denied. It's purely arbitrary on the part of the checkpoint soldiers, whether they'll let somebody through or not. So it's a very difficult situation in which that hospital is operating, as is true for Palestinians of all sorts all the time. They have to go through Israeli control to do anything, any movement.
I just wondered if you, yesterday or whatever else you spoke this week, did you talk about the wall and how difficult that is for all the people?
We have
discussed that?
Yeah, we've talked about that, and I even handed out one session earlier this week, a map that shows where the wall is. And, so, yeah.
An amount of land and, that the Israelis have usurped.
Yeah. So tomorrow we'll talk about how can we put our money where our mouth is on this issue. What can we do with our investments, with our spending at local churches, what programs can we support that are helpful, and so forth. And what about our role as taxpayers? Okay?